Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Tonight's panel is incredible, is really distinguished, and I'll define that in just a second. The moderator, Tom Ashbrook, obviously the host of NPR's On Point, Brian McGrory. Brian McGrory, the editor of the Boston Globe. Ron Suskind, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and lecturer at Harvard Law School. And if you haven't read his book on life animated, I really encourage you the book or the movie. It's really quite moving. And then Heather Cox Richardson, Boston College history professor and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. So when I say they're distinguished, between the four folks up here, they have written 15 books. They have won 5 Pulitzers. There is a Livingston Prize for National Reporting, Nieman Fellow, leaders in real news, not fake news, and obviously educators. So it reminds me of the night when President Kennedy had the Nobel Prize winners at the White House, and when he said that, and thinking about these four individuals, I think it's the most extraordinary collection of talent, of human knowledge, that has ever gathered at the White House, with the possible exception when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. Welcome, and turn it over to Tom.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much. It's terrific to be here tonight. It's appropriate to be here together tonight. I don't know about all of you, but I have been in more fraught and wound up gatherings in the last 2 months than I can remember in any 2-month stretch maybe in my life. People looking to each other saying, what is going on? What has happened? Where are we? What's up with our country? There's a lot we want to talk about here tonight, but first, just impressions. What is this moment we're at? What has brought us to this pass and this man as president of the United States?
You know, I'm old enough. I'm 57. I've been covering this sort of thing for 30 years, I think, like Brian has. And you see steps along the path. You see Roger Ailes matching up with Dick Nixon to take advantage of that great Lyndon Johnson-Dick Russell moment. You know, if we pass these civil rights bills, Lyndon will lose the South for a generation. And Johnson says, well, it's sometimes worth that when you do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that grew the seedbed for a nativist program by Republicans to take advantage of that. There's a guy named Reed Irvine. Remember Accuracy in Media? Remember that guy in the 70s? And he started to say, everyone in the press is liberal, not appropriate honest brokers, the CBS and the New York Times, you know, and it was hard to say no to that. All of a sudden, you were having to protest against a bit of nonsense. To say that in what I put in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times is liberal because of my political beliefs, like accusing a doctor of malpractice, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. I work hard to not do that. Mm-hmm. But it was hard to wash that off you. Once he said it. You can see these step by step. You can see Ronald Reagan. Some of the innovations there with Reagan.
Innovations,
no doubt. An R&D lab for some of the stuff that we see now with Trump. I covered, you know, the Clinton presidency, but also the George W. Bush presidency, where I wrote in the New York Times kind of a signature piece in the 2004 period about the reality-based community. That was part of that Bush period. They said, people like you, Ron, are members of what we call the reality-based community. I said, well, if I'm a member of it, what is it? He says, well, you believe solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. I'm like, yeah. I've got a history behind me, empiricism, age of reason. Oh, we know. But that's not the way the world really works now. You see, we're an empire. And when we act, we create our own reality.
How did Iraq turn out?
Well, not so well, precisely. But you start seeing us loosing ourselves in our public dialogues from some of the anchors, some of the foundations upon which informed consent tended to rest. And that has grown to create this entity, this Trump. In some ways, he was, Brian, inevitable. Who would it be? Who could say? But someone like him would be, because he is now utterly loosed from these boundaries, these anchors. Virtually nothing the man says has been factual. The love-hate he has with the press is extraordinary. I guess those relationships are strong, love-hate relationships. But, you know, he hates us, but he can't get enough of us. And then he's playing us, often quite brilliantly, against ourselves. In a way, I don't like that line, he's the president we deserve, but he in many ways is the president we were right to fear. And we are going to in a way, be forced to call the question on democracy because of him in the years to come.
Are we at that point? Does it feel like we're at the furthest extension of the elastic here? Heather suggests, in a way, perhaps, that we are, that this is the wake-up call. This is the kick in the pants.
Well, I might have thought that with George W. Bush, but maybe not. You know, I mean, I covered all the Bush presidency, three books on the Bush presidency, where they were just lying right to reporters and laughing about it. They're saying, you know, it doesn't matter if we're caught in a lie. There's no accountability. There's no consequences. You know, and of course, Trump now has taken that to a next stage. Will there be someone after Trump that tries to do this and take it to a next evolution? Who can say? But clearly now, I think people are waking up to the fact that democracy, as Heather says, is a participatory sport.
Use it or lose it.
Either way, exactly.
Heather, take us back then. Does this echo earlier times? Is this unique in its sense of at the far end of the tether?
Well, those are separate questions. I want to start, though, by just telling everybody that what Ron just said about his reality-based community quote, I have to laugh because that is verbatim what you wrote in 2004. You know that quotation by heart.
Yeah.
And I know it by heart, too, because it was one of the most important quotations to come out of that entire decade. And
yes,
I was listening to him go through that, and I thought, he did not miss a comma in that entire quotation. And it's a whole paragraph long.
I could do a page or two if you want. But,
well, I'm not sure I could quote check you on a whole page, but that was great to hear. But it seems to me that Trump is a fascinating moment because he stretches back much farther than George W. Bush. I would argue that, in fact, the language that Trump uses, and this is different than who Trump is. Trump is a salesman, but the language that he uses is language that really came out of the New Deal, the people who opposed the New Deal, and an opposition to the New Deal that was articulated in 1951 by William F. Buckley, Jr., who said, listen, if we actually embrace the ideas in the Enlightenment, that if we put, you know, facts in front of people and make arguments, they keep picking the New Deal. And in a few years, he's going to say, and they pick Eisenhower, which is also a bad thing. So we can't actually rely on fact-based arguments. We have to simply indoctrinate people into the idea that, like the Ten Commandments, you cannot argue with what he called individualism, but was basically or liberty, which is basically the idea that people should be able to do whatever they wanted to do. So big businessmen could call the economic shots, and Christianity. Those two things are inviolable. So you can start from that premise, and you can argue about the details, but we must start there. But we don't actually have to adhere to any kind of factual argument, because then we lose. What we need to do is create a narrative, and this is, you know, what goes back to the idea of creating your own reality-based community, and the idea that you now have people standing in front of Congress trying to get, in front of the Senate trying to get confirmed for positions who clearly have no idea what those positions even entail because they don't need to know what those positions entail so long as they adhere to a correct ideology. Well, Trump took this language, stripped the veneer off it, and said, hey, I'm going to go get rid of the dog whistles and actually use resorting to sexism and to racism and convince you that all of your tax dollars are going not to help people at the bottom of the economic spectrum, but rather people of color or women who want abortions or illegal immigrants or any of these people that we've been accustomed to thinking of as being the bad guys, really since the 1950s and the 1960s and then, of course, into the 70s and finally into Reagan with his welfare queen and Willie Horton during the George W. Bush administration. And, you know, Trump picked that up incredibly effectively. But the reason that I find him fascinating as a historian is that's not all he picked up. He is a snapshot it seems to me, of America at the moment, when people recognized, people who had been voting for the movement conservatives who took over the Republican Party, when they recognized that that rhetoric, that narrative, had moved all the wealth in America dramatically upwards since 1980, which every set of statistics will tell you, so that they had been sold a bill of goods, and at the same moment that they recognized they'd been sold this narrative, this bill of goods, they recognized that something really wrong had gone on with the economy. And Trump identified both of those things. He's a salesman, and that brings up the other point about his concern about the media. He's out for Trump. I mean, he's just selling Trump. He wants attention. Everyone talks about his mental state. He's a completely different kettle of fish than a politician. He is out for Trump. But as a snapshot of history, of American history, it seems to me he's the moment when the rubber hits the road and ideology does not meet reality, and Americans look at it and go, this is not the country we signed up for, and they work to take it back.
Trump to take it back.
Not Trump. Not Trump taking it back.
The opposition to Trump.
But opposition to Trump taking it back, yeah.
You've got that confidence that it's not the...
Hey, listen, I'm whistling in the dark, but someone's got to.
Well, yes. We'll come back. Brian, narrate your version of the story, of the march that led us.
Oh, we've had 20, 30 years of virtual paralysis in Washington, mm-hmm. with a couple of exceptions, maybe around 9/11. Mm-hmm. We have government that just doesn't work for people. We have inequality that is at historic levels, and I think
not least in this city.
This is one of the worst cities in the world in terms of inequality of opportunity. And I think if you look around the Midwest, where Trump really won this thing in a surprising fashion, these are people who just looked at Washington and said, whatever we have right now doesn't work. And they look past the misogyny, they look past the bigotry, they look past all the obnoxious, thuggish, even piggish traits of this man. And they said, we're willing to take a flyer on anything different because what we have seen simply does not work for the decrepit towns that we're in right now, mm-hmm. in our own family lives. And so, you know, when we talk about taking America back, I think we need to see this play out a little bit more before we realize what there is to take back.
Are you sympathetic at some level, Ron, with exactly that American who looked out, wasn't feeling so good about their prospects at all, yeah. said, the hell with this, I'm going Trump?
Yeah, you know, look, I've traveled to these parts of America. In some ways, the divisions between the coastlines, mostly caught on the updraft of the global economy, and the wide middle is as dramatic as the North and the South part of the Civil War. It's deep, these divides. You know, this is predominantly, in many cases, in many parts, a left-behind country, or so they feel. And... you know, I've been writing about left-behind characters for my whole life. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to them, you hear just what Brian was saying. Look, all I know is what doesn't work. And the government is not redressing grievance in my case. So I want someone to just smash it. Just that's what I'm electing him for. The rest is for later, for never. But first, I just got to smash what is.
I've heard this again and again in the last year.
You hear it, and it's hard to argue with them because almost as soon as you start to talk, they hear our voices, and they go, you're inaudible to me.
Mm-hmm. And you're sitting pretty. I'm not, so
you
shut
bet.
Up.
We're way up in line, mm-hmm. and people butt in front of me mm-hmm. well before you.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I think that's at the core of these issues of inequality that we've seen growing over the last 40 years. You know, and I think there's been a failure, frankly, in some cases of the Democratic Party, to articulate, you know, how we can remedy this loss of a sense of possibility in most people's or many people's lives. You can't have 40% of the economy, rather 70% of the economy, having no raise in 40 years, while so much of other parts are advantaged. Look, inequality is what crushes societies. Mm. You know, our sense of well-being is all comparative. That's what all the social scientists mm-hmm. and psychologists mm-hmm. say. And the gaps are so vast here that there are many people saying, you know, I want him to just bloody your nose, you. I'm pointing
start
at you.
Start with that. Let's just start there.
That's what I want. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm electing now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite personal, actually. You know,
meaning?
Well, you know, at one point during the Bush administration, a guy named Mark McKinnon, who was one of Bush's advisors, very skillful, you know, sort of nimble fellow, said to me, he said, "You think George W. Bush is an idiot?" I said, I don't actually think he's an idiot. I think he's incurious. I think he's a bully. I think he's hard to brief because I think he suffers from ADD. But I don't think he's, no, you do. And they do in the coastlines, and they do in some parts of lower Manhattan near Wall Street. But let me just tell you, we don't care. Because you guys are outnumbered 2.5-1 by the big beating heart of the middle. And you know what they love about him? They love the way he points. The way he walks, that kind of W walk,
Texas,
with the arms out. That kind of tight sphincter thing he does with his hips. And,
hadn't thought
you
of
know, kind of, you know, and they'll never read the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Boston Globe. You know, they just like the way he gives them a sense of confidence. But here's what they don't like. They don't like you. So keep attacking them. Every time you do, our numbers go up. Now just think about that quote from 2004 and how Trump takes that to a next level. You know, it's deeply personal. And for people to say they can't even vote in their own interest. Look, I quoted Tom Frank's book often, What's the Matter with Kansas? You know, and folks out there say, so you're telling me that I don't know my own self-interest? Let me tell you my self-interest. My self-interest is in blooding your nose is my self-interest. How's that feel? And it's not born of your rationalism. It's born of my emotional needs to feel like I'm making progress in my life by stopping you.
Starting
and getting
there.
A government that somehow recognizes me. Now we can negotiate. And then I have to decide whether I want to burn your building down. That's my next choice. Are you ready to talk now? That's kind of what's happening here. And it's really a fear-based narrative that's quite shattering to our complacencies.
Brian, you're rising to that.
The many things I didn't expect to think about tonight, it was George W. Bush's sphincter.
That's a bonus.
I do appreciate that.
Did you do a three-part series on that at one point?
Look, during the campaign, the mainstream media, meaning you know, conventional media, believed that Donald Trump was a perfect foil for Hillary Clinton in this campaign, that if she showed up at debates and she acted as competent as she is, if that she highlighted the experience she has, if she exuded the kind of moderate tone that she has, that everything would be fine. And that seemed to be her strategy. In the end, what I think we all realized was that Hillary Clinton was a perfect foil for Donald Trump. That she was everything that a good part of this country simply did not want anymore. He would have had a much, much bigger problem running against a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren.
No doubt.
Or Joe Biden.
No doubt about it.
Heather, our system puts a lot of faith in the sort of native wisdom of the people. Now, the people, not by a majority, but under our rules, have just elected Donald Trump. Do you look at that decision and say there's a kind of wisdom there?
That's an interesting way to put it. Isn't the central question really how we think about democracy and the way a society should work?
That's what I'm trying to get at, I guess.
That is, there is some level at which what Ron is saying is a reflection of an idea really that has always been around, that the people who should run society are the very few educated, usually white, usually men, who are going to tell the rest of us how to run our lives. And that stands in stark contrast to another concept of a working society, and that is the idea that people are driven to think about the world in such a way that it will benefit them, and that democracy works best when everybody is able to have a say in their own government, in the way government works. And in a way, those two ways of looking at the world have always been at war in America. They've always, and in many societies, I guess I only study America as well, and that what people have reacted to this round is saying, wait a minute, we don't want a society where only a few people at the top are telling the rest of us how to behave. And that's a reflection not simply on the Republican Party, but also on the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of Trump voters were angrier at what they saw as Democrats and academics and journalists and people telling them what they had to be concerned about than the reality of the fact that they're not making any money. That being said, there is a deeper problem, I think, personally, in our education system that so many people could not get past the rhetoric, past the emotional story, and look at the reality of their lives and demand politicians who would answer that.
Where does that leave us in terms of your confidence going forward?
I love how I always end up being the one interpreted as being the confident one.
You know, well, I did hear you suggest that we would rise to a challenge. You know, it doesn't always go that way. We've seen other countries and other times where we come to a point like this and things keep going.
I believe every other day I think that's what's going to happen. But every second day, I look at the fact that we look so much like we did in the 1850s when a lot of people had been going on with their lives not paying attention to the fact that the entire government was being taken over by a bunch of slave owners. And when they finally woke up to that fact, they fought back, took the country back over, gave us the Gettysburg Address, and rededicated America to the concept that all men are created equal. Worked for me. And I kind of hope that that's where we're going again. And I actually have confidence not simply in progressive voters, but in a number of people I know who voted for Trump. Who voted for Trump not because they hate America or they hate women or they hate African Americans or that they hate immigrants, but because they hated the fact that they felt that they no longer had say over their government and they were determined to take that back. And if you look now, if you follow Twitter, you know, Evan McMullen out of Utah, you know, who would ever have thought that I would be retweeting Evan McMullen out of Utah? And there we are. There's a number of people coming together to redefine America as a place where everybody has a say in their own self-determination. And that is, after all, what we stand for.
What about the darker fears that are out there, Brian? People have been talking about Sinclair Lewis lately and his book, It Can't Happen Here, 1935. And the scenario is that Huey Long, or a Huey Long-like figure, defeats FDR. And it came out in 35, I think the same year that Huey Long was assassinated. But here's a passage from that book where things are going further off the rails. Sinclair Lewis imagining the U.S. going the way of Mussolini or Hitler's countries at the time. Why are you so afraid of the word fascism, Dormus? Just a word. It might not be so bad with all the lazy bums who got panhandling relief nowadays and living on my income tax and yours. Not so worse to have a real strong man like Hitler or Mussolini, like Napoleon or Bismarck in the good old days, and have him really run the country and make it efficient and prosperous again. In other words, have a doctor who won't take any back chat, but really bosses the patient and makes him get well whether he likes it or not. This is Sinclair Lewis thinking about our country in the 30s. Do you see a real risk of the darker side of Trump taking and the folks who have rallied behind him going further off the rails?
Look, first, I...
Not to say it's necessarily off the rails, but here we are at a pretty giddy moment.
I do believe in the wisdom of crowds, maybe the O.J. Simpson jury aside. In this case, it's convoluted because the crowd actually said Hillary Clinton. It was tailored in the system we have to allow for Donald Trump. But the majesty of democracy in the United States will not allow this to go off the rails, to use your phrase. I think we could see a rebound here. I think that we could, this could be our darkest moment. What worries me, I'm trying to express confidence here, but here's what really worries me. What worries me is a Republican Congress in a conservative Supreme Court. And all the stars are lined up for some real damage to be done here. The truth is that when Trump was first elected, when we went back to November, I actually thought, there's a scenario here in which this may not be bad. I had to consult the newsroom. We could see our first post-partisan president in many decades.
Mixing up the lines.
We could have a Democratic, we could have as many Democrats in the cabinet as we do Republicans. Mm-hmm. We could have him telling, the Freedom Caucus on the Hill to take a hike. Republicans would be as frustrated by him as Democrats, and he could take that opportunity with a massive infrastructure program, perhaps centered on urban public schools, and really do this country some good. It's been extraordinarily disappointing ever since when we end up with a cabinet filled with white male billionaires who someone alluded to earlier barely seem to know the departments that they're running, and a couple of cases, you know, wanted to get rid of the department, at least in the case of Rick Perry. So, all of that said, well, I believe in the wisdom of crowds, and I think that this democracy will survive. The stars are lined up for some really difficult moments.
You believe that it won't go off the rails, that the majesty of American democracy will turn it around. Describe how that happens.
Well, it's not far from how Heather described it. The public will not stand for this. It was a really interesting Atul Gawande essay in The New Yorker earlier in January about how even when this nation's massive institutions fail us, and we've seen a diminishing effect on by these institutions, the major parties, the Congress, over the last 20 years or so, we are still a good, reasonable, sensible, logical people. And the smaller institutions in our society will not allow for a dictator-like figure in Washington to control the lives that we live.
I wonder, and I think back to New Year's, when Trump tweeted out the New Year's greeting, which was something like, Happy New Year's to all my enemies, who just can't get over how I win and all their losses. And I thought to myself, from the small portions of democracy. My dad was on the school board back in my hometown. If the superintendent of schools had put out a letter like that, they would have had his butt out of that chair in, 1 week. They would have said, this man is not suited to be superintendent of our schools. This is the president of the United States, and he tweets this, and we go right on. So I wonder about this.
He couldn't get past the HR office of most major companies right now, given his actions. But so he's breaking every mold and every rule.
Give us Brian imagined a hopeful scenario here, and maybe it feels less hopeful now. Do you still see one, Ron? Do you see a way in which this could? I mean, look at it in the most Trumpian way that you can for a minute, or somebody who will break China and...
I love what you're doing there, Tom. You're fabulous.
I love you right back, Vlad. Let's go horseback riding.
What's he doing there? I don't know what that's about.
It's twirly stuff.
My wife won't let me do this in the house, so I have to do it out.
We love what you're doing, Ron.
Well, I mean, it's like, you have Nixon, Eldridge Cleaver, and Trump. That's the Trump hand.
It's almost papal, but
it is.
Not.
It's a funny little.
It is. Thing. It's short.
I can. Like my hopeful scenario is aligning with Brian's, actually. I mean, Trump is, remembered, destroyed the Republican Party as well. There's not a Republican Party that certainly existed 10 or 15 years ago.
So destroyed that it controls almost all the state houses and both
yeah,
all,
right,
houses
but
of Congress
it's
and
true.
The White House.
I mean, I hear you. But, the fact is they are deeply divided. He slaughtered the whole stage of people. I mean, look, he's really sort of a maverick, but without, thought behind the positions mostly. I mean, but think about, tariffs to protect manufacturing jobs. That's a Democratic position prior to the Clintons. He picked and chose rather nimbly here. Across the traditional party divisions. That provides an avenue for opportunity. If his narcissism is so deep and profound that he starts to feel the heat of not having delivered on his bold promises, especially to that constituency in the middle, you can see him potentially hustling across the traditional divides, throwing people out of this window and that. I mean, I think he's going to run this thing a little like he ran Celebrity Apprentice, where, he does everything in public. He'll fire many of these cabinet members in very public ways. There's no doubt about that.
No doubt.
You're fired. You're out. He'll do it in where you can see it. That's reality show values.
Yeah.
But there is an opportunity for him to shatter the stasis and deep divisions.
You still see that despite the cabinet that he's named?
I see it as a marginal and modest mm-hmm. possibility. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The dark side, if you want me to do that part, is
okay.
that... Sorry, my wife's like, try to be more hopeful. It's hard these days. Is that I wrote a lot about foreign affairs during the Bush era and talked to leaders of foreign countries. They are feeling very entrepreneurial right now.
Yeah. Opportunity knocks.
Yeah. And I can see them coming up with strategies to create crises in America. In some ways, Trump is ideal in that he is so easily drawn into crisis.
Provoked.
Some of that is part of his whole sort of architecture. He's a guy who creates crisis out of nothing, in mm-hmm. any case, out of words. Mm-hmm. But if he can't deliver for this angry constituency of his, he probably will move to crisis and distraction, as some dictatorial types do, to keep that crisis moving again and again. You can't get your bearings, can't mm-hmm. get your feet in the ground. And others may help him along those lines. Remember, the whole Al-Qaeda model was they can never defeat a country of our might. But if they attacked us in a certain way, they could have us overreact mm-hmm. and
the
show that
move.
Our principles, exactly, Tom, mm-hmm. that are really the source of our real power, mm-hmm. These rights that are inalienable, that they're really brittle, that they're matters of convenience, that they're easily shattered. That's the goal of many countries, including Putin, frankly. Mm-hmm. And Trump is just ideal to prove their case on that. And that's what I really fear. I fear we're going to end up in a place of crisis for all the reasons that have happened, like 9/11 and
despite
elsewise.
All his criticism of the endless war.
Absolutely. And he will react in ways that will leave us dizzy using the toolkit he's been using up to now. That's my dark side.
Is there any way that he could maneuver with this Republican Congress to actually go for these unorthodox solutions?
Yeah.
Well, really? Is Paul Ryan going to work with him to do non-Republican big solutions that break the norms, that break the lines? Or will they strand him so all he has left is executive authority, which leans toward crisis and even more?
I mean, that's the big question right now. You know, you can see Trump with a set of choices here. Mm-hmm. Does he abide by the already acquired Republican constituency and orthodoxy mm-hmm. of the Paul Ryans? Mm-hmm. Or does he go, you know, that's not working, and I'm going to go in a different direction? That means, you know, I may bump off some of these Republican leaders, but have them try to challenge me. You know, it's about power and it's exercise. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be, I think, a struggle in this opening period where Trump tries to assert primacy. And some of the Republicans are saying, look, we already have a playbook. Just check mm-hmm. off the boxes. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't think he's going to do that. I don't. Mm-hmm. I think
because he'll feel too bound in if he does that.
No, exactly. He'll lose so much of essentially the source of what gives him his power, mm-hmm. which is surprise. You know, Trump actually occurs on television, like sports.
Occurs.
You can't keep your eyes off him because he occurs right there in the screen. He knows how this works. Mm-hmm. He's off script all the time. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you go to the hockey game for the fight. You can't stop watching it. And he's going to keep using that. He knows how that works. So he's going to keep, I think, fueling surprise, moving against expectation. Creating these moments of havoc, often quite personal to his opponents. And some of them, I'll tell you, will be within the Republican Party soon enough. Then we'll get to a point of whether the Republican-led Congress says, look, let's let him drift out and off the edge and put Mike Pence in as president.
What does that mean exactly, mechanically?
Mechanically, I think that Trump is so far off the grid on many things that end up in legal proceedings, mm-hmm. that he may stand in the crosshairs of conviction, legal conviction, of being convicted of crimes or being involved in criminal activity or activity that ends with impeachment. And I think there may, a year from now, be lots of Republicans who say, great. Mm-hmm. Okay, he did his turn. He created the disruption.
He's got Mike now right there.
Now let's put our man Pence in. He's been a governor. He knows how the government works. He's our guy. And let him be the president. That's another scenario, which I think is a possible scenario for the up ahead.
Heather, what are you thinking here? And if you've got historical parallels or enlightening tales, tell us stories from the past that warm us by the fire.
We have been here. We have been here before, and nobody ever remembers this. Where we are right now looks very much like, believe it or not, the Benjamin Harrison administration, which I'm sure all of you know by heart. I know. I hate to talk about him because everybody already knows so much about him.
When's that movie coming out, the Benjamin Harrison story?
Hey, come on, the Garfield story.
Garfield,
now
that's a
okay, tell us. We're all ears.
So Benjamin Harrison was elected in the Electoral College. He lost by 100,000 votes, popular vote, and he decided that he had been put in place by God. And even though, in fact, there were machinations that made him president and he really should not have been president, he decided that he and his Republican majority in the House and the Senate and the Supreme Court, a Supreme Court that nobody even remembers the name of the Chief Justice of that Supreme Court. Does anybody happen to know that one? Nope, not Salmon Chase. It was Melville Fuller. It's known as the Lochner Court, which is interesting because we've erased it entirely from our memory, but they gave us an incredible slew of pro-business, anti-individual legislation. They declared an income tax unconstitutional. They went in Ray Deb saying the government could essentially hunt down an individual. They came up with all sorts of machinations. They did give us Plessy v. Ferguson. They gave us the Insular cases. They gave us all those cases that all got overturned or forgotten because they were so out there, so off the grid. But what he did and what the Republicans did under Harrison is they pushed their agenda so extraordinarily and so extraordinarily hard that they lost not only the Democrats who didn't like them, they lost not only the anarchists who didn't like them, they lost most moderate Republicans who said this is not a democracy any longer when you've got one small group putting themselves in power and creating a world in which the rich get everything. And you think about that date, that's 1888. By 1890, they've wiped African-American voting off the map, largely thanks to the Mississippi Constitution and thanks to the constitutions that are adopted all over the northern states to make sure that poor people and black people can't vote. By 1896, they have basically blood in the streets guaranteeing that nobody but Republicans can vote. Sounds like we're going in a really bad direction. By 1901, we have Teddy Roosevelt in the presidency, and we have the beginning of the progressive era. So you look at that scenario in 1896, and you say, we are going to hell in a handbasket. We've got international uprisings. We've got people being assassinated by anarchists all over America, including William McKinley, who's going to go in 1901. And you think, there's no way we're going to come out of this. This is going to end up being essentially an oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And within a decade, we have the progressive era, one of the most progressive moments in American history.
Are the elements that let that turn around then extant now?
Well, the thing that I find fascinating is the extraordinary level of voter suppression and gerrymandering right now, and the idea that you're basically destroying the popular vote. We are taking the vote away and suppressing the vote all over the country, and you think, well, there's just no way to come back from that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except there was. In the late 19th century, when people said, wait a minute, what happened to the concept of democracy? And again, if you look at the vote in 1892 and 1896, you think there's just no way that there's ever going to be anything other than a full, basically oligarchical government, and it turns around because most people say that's not what we want. We believe in American principles.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the mechanics that's a problem, was a problem in the last election, which was such a problem with the gerrymandering, especially in the swing states and in the red map states. That is a problem that looks very similar as it is today. But crucially, I think the other thing that happened in the late 19th century and that is waiting to happen today and was picked up by Trump and by Bernie Sanders is the fact that politicians began to articulate a vision of America that people could get behind. They began to talk about a narrative in which individuals should be able to rise, should have a voice in their own government, in a way that they had not talked about America really since Abraham Lincoln. And the reclaiming of an American narrative of a land in which people should have self-determination and the land should actually be a land of hope for people resonated with regular folks, regular Republicans at the time, Democrats, and even anarchists who would say, I can get behind those ideas. I want to be part of that. And this is, again, a magical moment when people in the media will, I hope, and politicians will turn around and say, wait a minute, let's articulate a vision as opposed to slicing and dicing an electorate simply to get votes on a ballot. Let's articulate a vision that America can get behind to reclaim its concept of itself as an important figure in world history.
And you believe the United States population today has the same software in there somewhere that would respond in this way that it did 100 years, 100
I believe
plus?
That human beings have that software.
Well, they went for many thousands of years without pulling that off so
and
well.
And we have a lot in our DNA. I wish we had not cut back on public education the way we have. That, I think, is the elephant in the room, but... But we're doing our best to take it back, right?
Yeah. Inequality is very interesting to me here because Trump made a lot of hay on it, even though he's a billionaire. I observed Democrats, while they talked a lot about it, and Bernie Sanders in particular, and maybe in a unique way, a lot of other Democrats, there's a kind of... people got accustomed to the fact that somewhere out there there were people not doing so well, but it didn't require an emergency action because they were doing fine. I think at some level there were Democrats who felt that way. How do we turn inequality around? Which comes first here? Is there some political backlash that turns around in another way? Can we turn the cart without addressing inequality? Is inequality the thing that ends up being the fuel for yet another turn of the cart? Trump used it for his revolution, whatever you want to call it. How do we address it? There's so many people have such a vested interest in it. The Congress has been, as you say, kind of stuck in ineffectual mode for a long time. In part, it seems to me, because it's paralyzed by protecting the interests of those who are doing quite well now. How do you change that, if changing that is part of changing the politics of the country?
So the question could also be asked, can Trump change inequality? I mean, he had a bizarre argument with the public during this campaign. He talked about inequality. If you look at it, his message and the Sanders/Warren message weren't that different. And they even used some of the same words. Mm-hmm. The system is rigged. The system is rigged against people like you.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump had a message on top of that message, and that is, I know how to win. So, you know, he'd constantly be talking mm-hmm. about, and I bet you can do a beautiful imitation, winning, winning, winning.
That wasn't bad, though. Yeah, winning, winning. You got to get the hands.
And... So the question is, will Trump use something like a massive infrastructure program that could put people who don't have college educations to work, could put middle America to work, and could actually be honed in on things like public schools in this country? And could that be a vehicle to try to break inequality? It doesn't look like appointing a cabinet filled with... middle-aged and older white billionaires is the way to solve inequality. So there are some real reservations over whether his interest was sincere in this.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? Getting to one of Ron's earlier points, the way that Trump could actually win Washington is a way that I think he's probably innately capable, and that is to simply act like an adult. He did it very briefly when the Republicans tried to gut the ethics office in the middle of the night, and he sent out a tweet saying that was ill-advised, and he spun that around immediately. If he were to act like an adult and he would bring both parties together, I think he could make a lot of headway on issues like inequality, but I don't think that it's in his mettle to be able to do that.
Right.
Well, you know, there are opportunities in his hands. I mean, you know, in this divided era, what works is Nixon to China is to move against type. And Trump has a whole array of potential Nixon to China moves, especially on inequality. I mean, you know, if we talk a lot about narrative. I mean, Trump is an agent of an ancient narrative of the prince who leaves the palace, walks among the people and then returns often to burn the palace down. But he does that. He leaves the golden coastlines where he has literally his own set of golden temples. He walks among the people, says, "I am your voice." He has agency here. And with agency comes opportunity. And one of the questions is, with him having this acute desire to please people in a way, and this is part of his dynamic, certainly people that have said, "You're our man," whether he will be advised by wise agents to say, "Look, here is a way you can break from the current set of stale policy options," which are pretty stale, and win laurels, and your audience, your Q ratings will skyrocket. But, you know, I'm indeed similarly sort of dispirited by the cabinet choices. But ultimately, he will now act. It'll be his decision, and he rules and operates from the gut, by fiat, and surprise is his friend. So there are opportunities here.
May I ask you, Heather?
Healthcare. Yeah. I don't expect to see it, but man, if that man pulled single-payer health care out of his sleeve, that is an absolute game changer. And the trick to Trump is, before he does anything, you've got to go with, "You're not the boss of me." You know, he'll do whatever people don't expect him to do just to prove he can.
Exactly right.
So I've been watching that one.
What's your call to citizens, not whoever is in this hall tonight, how to engage with this time, how to engage with the next, I don't know what it's going to be, 18 months, 4 years, 8 years. Heather?
Well, I would say, first of all, care. You know, participate and care in stuff you believe in. But as frightening as this moment is for many of us, whose rights are really on the line, it is at the same time, as you say, a time both of tremendous fear but also of tremendous opportunity. And I look at it and, you know, often I wake up in the morning and I think, why? You know, why couldn't I have had a simple life? And then I think, we get to live through one of the great crises in human history,
awesome.
Which is really what we're living through. And but it's in our hands. And this is the moment when the rubber kind of meets the road and you have to say what you believe in and what you stand for. And frankly, I would prefer not to have had to do that. But given the fact that I don't seem to have a choice, it seems like embracing it is not a bad thing to do, because what we do is going to matter an awful lot more in a lot of ways than what our parents did and what our children do. And that's not a bad position to be in.
My God, you're awesome. Ron, your clarion call, Ron.
Well, I would say take the long view, like Heather does. History's arc, it's long, but it does bend towards justice. Maybe not in a way you can see clearly day to day, but it does. You know, all of human history is the same story of the outcast, the outlier, finding a place at the shared table. That's been going on in America for some decades, despite a government that doesn't function. More and more, the borders globally don't matter. We're in a very different planet where information is held in a PDA, 1,000 libraries of Alexandria. It's lifting the planet. People are powerfully self-activated in ways they've never been before, even in the hollows of the world, in the deep valleys. All of that's going on. It's not going to stop. You know, day to day, try to get out of the swings of fear and hate and anger and, oh, my God, because they pass. You know, my friends in Washington say there's no scandal that lasts more than 48 hours these days. I think it's more than like 24 hours. They come and they go. There'll be scandal fatigue that's already probably setting in. And I think the key is to keep your eye on that long arc. Because it is actually bending in the right direction, despite all of the nonsense that is dominating our daily breath and life. And that's the way that I think you survive during this time. And also, it's a moment where your grandkids will say, if you have any, what did you do during that time? Mm-hmm. That's a moment of opportunity. You want to have stories to tell them. And I think that's incumbent upon each of us. You know, I mean, this is a tough time for me. I've got a son who is disabled, who's autistic.
Mm-hmm. We've heard him. We've heard him on NPR. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Owen. And you know, to see Trump, you know, abusing disabled people, I mean, I just, you know, I could not contain my anger. And Owen and I talked about that. You know, he saw that when Trump did that. Mm-hmm. He knows people like that.
Mm-hmm.
He
we all do.
Is, lives in that world in many cases. And he has a lovely allegory that he created really in response to what the world saw of him over the years. At one point he said, look, I'm not seen as a hero. I'm not a hero. I'm a sidekick. And that broke our hearts, Cornelia and I. He was only 11. Mm. Of course, we say, oh, I wish he felt like the hero. He said, no. You see, the sidekick is crucial. You see, they help the hero fulfill their destiny. Without them, nothing happens. And wow. The beauty of that allegory, as he grows now, he's 25, he says, you know, actually, I think we're all really sidekicks. At our best when we help others fulfill their destiny. And on that day, we find our inner heroes. Now, that definition of heroism is beautiful. And it's one everyone here can embrace. That's what will change the fabric of what we call America, which is really just an idea in the years to come. Find your inner hero by helping others fulfill their destinies. And in that way, you'll fulfill your own.
Get up, stand up.
You bet.
Brian, do editors do clarion calls?
Not as well as historians and authors, to be honest. But look, I would just take it to the most basic level, and that is, and I understand the sentiment to ignore what's unfolding. I would advise people to watch, to understand deeply what you oppose, to capture the moment in history. I'd suggest that you fully appreciate that the majesty of democracy and the resilience of our people will overcome the foibles of our individuals or the torture of specific moments. More important, I would subscribe to a newspaper.
Amen. Amen. I'm not going to try and top this. I simply want to thank everyone for gathering. Just this gathering is a kind of civic action. And I hope there are many, many more to come. I want to thank the Kennedy Library for this evening. It's wonderful. It just feels good to be here with all of you, and certainly with you. I am heartened by this night, and let us be strong and make it right. Thank you. Thank you and good night. Thank you very much. Thank you.